It's my pleasure to introduce Mike Carvin, who is the Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, who will be introducing Ms. Meese.
Thank you. Before I introduce Mr. Meese, I should explain why I'm here. I was strolling around in the lobby in informal garb, and I was told that Ken Cribb couldn't make it. I think he's working on something else right now. But it's an unexpected pleasure, but not an unwelcome task to introduce Mr. Meese. As you all know, he's the Attorney General of the United States. Before that, he worked with Governor Reagan as his Chief of Staff in California. Contrary to what Senator Rudman and others think, he's had extensive prosecutorial experience in Alameda County as the Deputy District Attorney down there. The one thing that I do want to say, without going into any more detail in his public life, because that's familiar to all of you, is what I've gotten out of my experience at the Department of Justice with working with General Meese and more directly with people like Brad Reynolds. And it's the message that I think we should all take out of here when we think about what the Department of Justice has accomplished in the last 4 to 8 years. And that is that it's raised public consciousness, it's raised public debate about a number of issues that are very important to us. It's made it clear, even though you tend to forget it in Washington, that ideas do have consequences, that a sustained, articulate, persuasive argument on great issues can have an effect on the public and can change the way society works. In the Civil Rights Division, our primary focus was on the issue of affirmative action. It met with mixed results in the court. It hasn't been 100% successful, and we haven't achieved a rule of law where colorblindness is the absolute standard. But even though that effort wasn't entirely successful, I think our lasting contribution in civil rights was to get people to talk about a lot of ideas and a lot of legal doctrines that have a very direct effect on their lives, that affect their daily existence. Prior to the Reagan administration, I think that all too often issues like religion, affirmative action, that sort of thing, were essentially the exclusive preserve of an elite group of lawyers. These decisions were being made in Washington, in federal courts, and in law schools without any understanding on the part of the people being affected how they were being made and why they were being made. And what Brad Reynolds and others did for the issue of affirmative action, I think General Meese has done for the entire question of the role of the courts in our society. He's reemphasized in his actions and his words that we are a system of limited powers, that the courts do have a limited role in our government, and that the jurisprudence they must follow is that of the original intent of the framers. Again, I don't know if that will be entirely successful in the court. I think its ultimate fate is uncertain at this point. But I think what we do know now is that people are asking questions because the debate has been raised, because the level of consciousness has been increased by virtue of the actions of this administration, this Justice Department. So whatever the ultimate fate, whatever the result in the courts of accepting particular doctrines in particular areas or a method of jurisprudence, the point is that people are now aware that they've got to ask not what the result was in a particular case, but what the court's authority was to issue that result. And for that reason, I think that we all owe a large debt of gratitude to the Attorney General, and it's my great pleasure to introduce him. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mike, thank you. Thank you very much, Mike, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for that warm welcome. I recognize as I stand here that I'm the last speaker on your program, and that has a particular responsibility because I'm what stands between you and the cocktail reception. I also have this feeling of temerity because I realize that I am standing on the same platform where yesterday and today you've had a most eminent array of lawyers and scholars addressing you on topics relating to foreign policy. As a matter of fact, I feel a little bit about like the principal character in that story that I'm sure some of you have heard, the story about the lawyer who died and went to heaven, and that's not the joke. But in any event, upon arriving and walking towards the pearly gates, he noted that quite a commotion was taking place. A large crowd had gathered. The heavenly equivalent of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was present, and St. Peter himself was in attendance. And so as the lawyer came up, he asked, "What's this all about? What's going on here?" St. Peter came over and said, "Why, sir, it's for you." The lawyer said, "Well, I'm amazed, I'm astonished." He said, "I led a relatively good life on earth, but nothing like this." Well, St. Peter said, "Well, the reason is twofold. First of all, we don't get all that many lawyers up here. And secondly, in your case, we have never had before a lawyer who was 172 years old." Well, the lawyer says, "There must be some mistake." Said, "I distinctly remember at my last birthday that I was only 65 years old, and so you just have it wrong." St. Peter says, "No, sir, there's no mistake. We verified your age from the timesheets you've used to bill your clients." Well, once again, the Federalist Society is sailing into the wind, as it were, and bringing its awesome intellectual firepower to bear on some of those issues of the law and of public policy which are among the hottest of the day. This bicentennial, which we have celebrated, of our Constitution, has been a year in which public attention in this session, as well as in other fora, has been focused on such things as the War Powers Resolution, arms control negotiation, the Iran-Contra hearings, and the congressional debates over the president's actions and policy in the Persian Gulf. And so I can't think of a better time for the Federalist Society to take up this whole issue of the Constitution and foreign policy. I would say that in its relatively short but very intensive and potent history, the Federalist Society has promised an interesting experience for those who take part in its activities, and it has shown again in this conference that it can deliver on that promise. There's something that I'd like to emphasize about the Federalist Society and about its role in the legal and the political debate that goes on in our country. The Federalist Society, perhaps more than any other group, has been faithful in relating critical public policy issues to the Constitution and in consistently identifying the wellspring from which we should continually derive both our fundamental doctrines of government and the basis on which we take action and adopt positions on the key issues of our time. Several times a year in this Capitol and elsewhere throughout the country, much to the amazement of some of the news media, you have put on conferences that have attracted top conservative intellects from law and politics, as well as a few intellectually honest individuals from the other side of the aisle. But these conferences have not been exercises in some kind of philosophical antique hunting, but rather, in part because of the way in which the society has approached these issues, they have been bold explorations of what the future could look like. A future which we hope will increasingly be headed towards pro-freedom economics, pro-family social policies, and pro-constitution jurisprudence. And so that's why I'm pleased that here in a group which I'm sure includes the law school deans, the Supreme Court justices, and the attorneys general of the 21st century, you have been reaffirming your faith in the Constitution and as well as stimulating increased confidence in the system of small d democratic and small r republican politics that were established in that document. And you're ready, as has been demonstrated in the discussions here, to carry on the intellectual patrimony of James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Marshall, Joseph Story, Benjamin Curtis, John Harlan, and if you will, Robert Bork. You have my I want you to know that your efforts, started by the people that are here in front and others, certainly have my strong support and my good wishes for continuing success in all of these activities. Well, turning then to the major topic that brings you together today, the debate over the Constitution, foreign policy, and how original intent affects that policy. You have had, as I mentioned, a number of distinguished speakers, and many ideas have been discussed and presented. Many thoughts, I'm sure, have been left with you to take away. One finds that in considering the Constitution and foreign policy, this matter has a great deal to do with the relations between the executive and legislative branches. What are their respective authority, and also what are their respective limitations? Perhaps no other issue of public policy brings these topics of the relationship between the two branches into a sharper focus, nor has caused more turf battles, if you will, between the major departments of the government. It's my belief that both original intent and common sense call for a strong executive in foreign policy. And from what I understand among the speakers you've had today, I'm not alone in that view. And I also feel that the threat of encroachments on both original intent and common sense has a potential for great damage to our national security as well as our position in the world. I believe, furthermore, that the exact limits of both the executive and the legislative branches in foreign policy were deliberately left hazy by the Founding Fathers, and that the struggle to define them is more political, if you will, than constitutional or judicial. I'll explain in a moment the importance of this distinction, which I share with some of the other speakers. Now, there's some people who specialize in research concerning the Founding Fathers and the original constitutional debates who somehow claim to believe that the framers intended Congress to be the sovereign branch among the three branches, or that if we accept that they were co-equal, then at any rate, Congress is a little more co-equal than the other two branches, to adopt the phrase from George Orwell. Well, one possible source of this interpretation, political motivation to the side, is the way the authors of the Federalist tried so hard to assure their readers that the presidency under the Constitution would not be monarchical. But let's look at it this way. Why did some people worry that the presidency might resemble or take upon itself some of those attributes of the monarchy in the first place? It certainly didn't turn out that way, despite the media hyperbole from time to time about imperial presidencies. But just the same, I think we should recognize that Hamilton and Madison and Jay were, in a sense, on the defensive on this issue because the presidency was and is a powerful office. I could go on to say it was intended to be that way, and I'll explore that in just a moment. But at the time that the Federalist was written and that ratification was being urged, nothing like the presidency had existed under the Articles of Confederation. As a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons why this new nation was kind of a joke in international circles abroad. But let's get this straight. The belief that a legislature can do no wrong was not something that was intended by the framers. In fact, Madison wrote in Federalist number 51 about what he called the tendency of republican governments, namely governments represented in a legislative body, to an aggrandizement of the legislative at the expense of the other departments. And the Constitution itself shows a more concerted effort to rein in the powers of Congress than to do the same about the powers of the President. If we look at the text of their respective articles, particularly as those articles begin, in Article 2, which concerns the presidency, it straightforwardly confers the executive power upon the President, whereas Article 1, concerning Congress, confers, quote, all legislative power herein granted, unquote. Well, this would seem to suggest that while Congress was being given only certain enumerated powers, the President was being given all the powers implied by the term executive, according to the political theory and practice of that time. Now, again, we should not imply from this that the founders somehow intended that the powers of the presidency either would be unlimited. But I think it is clear, at least, that the framers did not envision a weak executive, or an executive whose actions were dependent upon the pleasure of Congress. The word that was most frequently used in the Federalist to describe the advantages that would be gained from a strong presidency was the word energy. This doesn't specifically mean that a president had to ride horses or chop wood, though if he does, that's clearly an added benefit. But it means, rather, that a president has to be able to act with dispatch, with firmness, and usually in foreign affairs, with secrecy, if he's going to be successful. These requirements come into their full relevancy in this matter of foreign policy. And Chuck Cooper earlier certainly gave you an excellent exposition of that and its relevance to your discussions. It's in foreign policy that a president's role is most clear and most complete, as he serves as both the spokesman and advocate, and in some cases, the agent and the negotiator for a nation. It's also there that he is most likely to encounter lawlessness and threats to the peace and security of the country, which he has to deal with expeditiously if he is going to carry out his role to defend the United States, as he has pledged to do. He has to deal with these threats to our security, not with a lawlessness of his own, not by going beyond the law, but by using fully, if necessary, the powers that the framers gave him when they gave him the so-called executive power on the one hand, coupled with the duty to provide for the defense of the nation. Well, let's look at the famous examples where presidents have used this power to the fullest. Thomas Jefferson, who himself, interestingly enough, had been a strong critic of centralized power, when he discussed this in the course of both before and after the Constitutional Convention with his fellow colleagues among the Founding Fathers, was the one who dispatched the Navy to Tripoli to quash the Barbary pirates. And the records show that he did that without consulting Congress first. We don't have to think much further in commemorating this particular event than remembering those words of the Marines' hymn when they sing about the shores of Tripoli. Another example, of course, is President Lincoln, who took a number of actions early in the Civil War that certainly strained the constitutional powers of the presidency to their limits, and some would even argue beyond. He took executive action which went in a different direction from that very famous decision of the Supreme Court. He ordered, in addition, a blockade of southern ports, and he suspended the writ of habeas corpus, taking both of those actions without any kind of a go-ahead from Congress. Well, Lincoln, of course, has taken criticism over the decades for some of these actions, especially from some of our good friends from Dixie. I'm not quite sure whether Ken Cribb has forgiven him yet. But his overarching motivation was to save the Union. That was what he was sworn to do, and of course, when the dust had settled, that's what, in fact, he had done. Another example of a president using his powers to the fullest, a president who comes from a different party, is that of Franklin Delano Roosevelt sending military aid to Britain after the fall of France in 1940. The Nazis at that time seemed like an unstoppable juggernaut. And here at home, by contrast, isolationism was strong, and Congress had consistently voted against military aid to our friends in Europe. But President Roosevelt saw that if Hitler defeated Britain and seized control of the British Navy, it would be a devastating blow to the freedom of the world. And so he heeded Churchill's pleas and found a way to send that aid. Many at the time and many since have questioned Roosevelt's actions, just as they did Lincoln's. But Robert Jackson, who was then serving as Attorney General, wrote an opinion finding that it was legal, although that issue has certainly been subject to great debate. But the presidential responsibility for preserving the national defense was fulfilled, again in this instance, by bold action on the part of the president. Yet another example more recently was President Kennedy clearly using his executive prerogatives when he quarantined Cuba and stood down the Soviets in 1962. Well, these are not the results of simply result-oriented pragmatism. All of these presidents had definite principles on which they based their particular courses of action, and that was that the principle exists that the executive must do what is necessary for the preservation of his nation. This principle was set forth in the extreme, if you will, by that theorist of early classical liberalism, John Locke. It's a principle that I think is important to discuss at the conclusion of a conference such as this, if we suppose, as I've already suggested, that in giving the president the executive power, the framers were taking a political concept that was clearly understood by contemporary observers of that time. Now, as we all know, the framers were very familiar with Locke, and he was among the many political theorists that had been well read by those that gathered in Philadelphia. Almost certainly, therefore, they were familiar with Locke's theory of executive prerogative. In his second treatise on government, Locke, on the one hand, calls the legislature the supreme power, using those terms indeed. But on the other, he affirmed a right and even an obligation of the executive even to go beyond the law when the executive's duties required it. In Locke's words, he said the executive should be able to act according to discretion for the public good without the prescription of the law, and sometimes even against it. There was a feeling in his writings that the executive must have the power and the ability to take whatever actions, however extreme, might be necessary in order to preserve the security and the essence of the nation, a rather extreme view of the extensive powers of the executive in any government. Of course, it's always perilous to argue directly from Locke to the intentions of the framers. But certainly it is important also to recognize the background with which they adapted Locke's views and then modified it to fit into the form of limited government, which ultimately was the basis for the Constitution. That's the reason that I don't think the framers adopted the theory of executive prerogative exactly as they found it in Locke, but rather I think they integrated it with the overall democratic structure that they were building as they developed the constitutional doctrines of 1787. Because for Locke, there was no earthly appeal against an invocation of executive prerogative. In his view, there was no check on its use. But on the contrary, in our system, even an executive who makes the fullest possible use of his prerogatives, such as a Jefferson or a Lincoln or a Roosevelt, faces two factors that limit his power. One is the possibility, of course, of electoral defeat, the fact that he has a limited term, and that either he himself or his party, if he fail, will face that electorate defeat if he fails to convince the electorate that his actions were necessary or proper. And the other check on him, of course, is the constitutional process of impeachment. In this way, in a sense, our Constitution improves upon Locke. According to Locke, the executive might have to, on certain occasions, go outside the law. But under our Constitution, I believe that the executive can exercise the power that Locke had in mind while staying within the law. Notice that both of the possible sanctions that act as checks on executive prerogatives, elections and impeachment, are democratic or political in nature. This is obviously so with elections. There's no better example of the exercise of democratic government. But even impeachment itself is democratic, since it forces both sides to air their differences in public, and since it is unlikely that Congress would vote to impeach a president without having first been convinced that most of the electorate was in agreement and supportive of such a step, or that they were in the process through the impeachment proceedings capable of convincing the electorate that that was so. And that's why, in this manner, the Constitution provides for the resolution of grave disputes over executive power by political means. This is in keeping with the general belief of the framers that democratic problem solving is the model that should be used in the United States. And ultimately, of course, since the authority of government is derived from the people, it is appropriate that political solutions be found to checking the power of the chief executive. And this brings me to what I consider a very important point that I understand others have discussed in passing about the relationship of executive to legislative power in foreign policy. I think it's clear that, as many of the writers in this field have said, the Constitution does not always give us hard and fast answers to all the questions about the relative position of executive versus legislative power. And here lies the importance of what I mentioned a moment ago, that the differences, even what some would describe as the turf wars in foreign policy between the executive and legislative branches, are political matters rather than the subjects for judicial determination in the judiciary's function of interpreting the Constitution. The Constitution, as I've often said in the past during this bicentennial year, is not a comprehensive legal code. It's not a high-level municipal code, if you will. But rather, it provides a framework of government setting forth the structure and setting forth the principles which should be followed in administering that government. The framers certainly didn't see it as their job to try to referee all future disputes between the branches. Rather, their concern was to fashion a political system that could accommodate and solve such disputes in the ordinary give and take of politics in a republic. Now, that's not to say that there is not some acts by either Congress or the President that would not be unconstitutional in this area. Certainly, some things would be definitely unconstitutional. But on the contrary, it is very clear, for example, that it would be unconstitutional for the President unilaterally to declare war. Likewise, it is unconstitutional, in my opinion, and in the opinion of some of the speakers today, for Congress to micromanage the deployment of our armed forces, whether in wartime or peacetime. And that's based upon very important experience that was had during the Revolutionary War, where the members of the Founding Fathers group themselves experienced in the Revolutionary War that you don't run a successful war by committee, as the Continental Congress had tried to do for a while until that power was given to a commander-in-chief. It's furthermore our position, as Vice President Bush said the other night in a very excellent speech, and as the Justice Department has argued recently in a footnote in a current brief, that the War Powers Resolution is unconstitutional. However, I think we would look in vain for a constitutional clause that precisely governs all the turf battles that take place between the two branches when it comes to foreign policy. And I think that that's because the framers understood they could not rigidly prescribe the exact relationships in all situations on into the future, but rather they left these struggles in the realm of politics. Well, one reason that the debate becomes so complicated is that it is often in the interest of one party or another in a political fight to try to make that fight seem like something else. In other words, to try to translate what is a political contest of wills, if you will, into a legal fight or perhaps even a constitutional fight. We see something of this sort in the attempt to portray the issue in the Iran-Contra affair as one of legal technicalities, rather than one of basic political questions, such as, what was it appropriate for the President to do about the fact that the Soviet Empire has been trying to consolidate a beachhead on the Central American mainland? Well, basically, people with certain views are attempting to make these views prevail without fighting an election over them, without resorting to the ultimate resolution in a political sense, and that is having the people determine which course of action or who is right in these kinds of battles. Should the United States allow the coming of Moscow-dependent communism or communist totalitarianism to the American mainland? If that simple issue was presented to the American people in a referendum, I don't think we have much doubt as to what the vote of the American people might be. But rather than face the electorate on those issues, some factions have sought to use the appropriations process, the advice and consent process on nominations, and even the ethics and government process to work their will rather than resorting to the political processes, either through the normal give and take between the executive and legislative branches or in any other way that could then be ratified or rejected at the next election. And so the call that I'm issuing today, along with others in this conference, is for a return to the framers' intention that the boundaries of legislative and executive authority, particularly in foreign affairs, be worked out politically. In a sense, I'm calling for politicization, but politicization of issues that are properly political, and not politicization of the law or of the Constitution. Above all, I would discourage any notion that the judiciary ought to be called in to reserve or to resolve these ongoing foreign policy turf wars. The political questions doctrine, unfortunately, may have been too often abandoned in domestic issues. But where foreign affairs are concerned, the Supreme Court and the other courts have generally shown admirable restraint. I praise this restraint, as I might add, I do most examples of judicial restraint, wherever we can find them, even when it is a case of liberal policy being challenged by a conservative, as for instance it was when Senator Goldwater sued to block President Carter's Taiwan Relations Act and the court dismissed the case. Well, treating foreign policy disputes as justiciable questions would certainly complete the unwarranted constitutionalization of policy differences. The right of the American people to choose their policies by electing their leaders would be the biggest loser. Some may object, of course, that a call for political resolution in foreign policy disputes militates against consensus in foreign affairs, and that is obviously a possibility. After all, from Pearl Harbor until the Tet Offensive, constantly we were told that American politics stops at the water's edge. And we certainly very badly need to renew that type of consensus, as you heard here today. Obviously, genuine consensus on the defense of our nation and its foreign policy interests is the best possible action. And certainly good faith efforts by both the executive and the legislative branches are essential if that's to be accomplished. I was pleased to note that my good friend and my next door neighbor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, presented both that concept as well as some helpful suggestions on how that might be achieved. But there are times when consensus cannot be attained between the two branches, where the gap is just too great between the ideas of, in a particular situation, whether it's the Persian Gulf or elsewhere, who should have the say on what goes on. And when that happens, the best way to get it resolved is candid political debate so the people can understand the issues and can make their views known through their elected representatives. The worst course of action, I would suggest, is to pretend that a dispute over fundamental policy differences should be unilaterally decided by the wording of an amendment in the appropriations bill, which the president is then coerced to sign by circumstances, and in which bad policy and unconstitutional usurpation of authority is made a part of the law because of the necessity of maintaining the ongoing funding of the government. Many have said that democratic politics, the kind of politics, the kind of give and take, the kind of candid discussion of issues that I've talked about, is messy. And indeed, sometimes it is. But I'm sure that I have no need to repeat for this group Churchill's famous remark about democracy being the worst system of government except for all the others. Well, there's no question that continual debate and controversy is an unwieldy way of conducting foreign policy. But that is precisely why the framers did provide in the Constitution that the principal power for the conduct of foreign affairs is set in a single executive. They went through all the arguments about energy and dispatch and secrecy. They went through their own experience during the Revolutionary War and the years that succeeded it prior to 1787. And they were clear that while certain powers were given to the Congress in the development of policy, of foreign policy, the conduct of foreign affairs lay strictly with the president. At the same time, they preserved the checks and balances on the executive by giving Congress those powers I mentioned, specifically the power to declare war and the power to appropriate funds for defense and in the truly extreme case, to impeach the president. So here, as in so many ways, we see the very careful manner in which the Constitution was balanced. This characteristic of the framers' work is why that famous document has lasted 200 years, during a period when many other constitutions around the world have foundered and have been replaced not one, but numerous times. So in this bicentennial, it's proper that we contemplate their work with special admiration and special awe. And perhaps again, in dealing with the subject of foreign policy and national security as you have today, the framework and the structure that is set forth in the Constitution again asserts itself as to why we have such an excellent basis and why, in obedience to that Constitution, it is paramount that the leaders of both branches should first determine how best they can get together and present a single strategy, a single view of what the policies of this country are. But that if they cannot, they should then work out a means for resolving the debate through quick, expeditious, candid, and civil actions between the two, so that we can get a resolution of the issue, and so the president can take those policies, once determined between the two branches, and then effectively implement them for the good of the nation and for peace in the world. Well, saying that, I wind up where I started, with the Federalist Society. It's you and those in law and politics who sympathize with you and adopt similar positions, who are keeping our written Constitution on the front pages rather than relegating it to a museum. Your deliberations this week have marked another contribution to the thinking and the discussion about how our living Constitution conveys the authority and the guidance for dealing with the critical public policy issues of our day. I congratulate you on what has been accomplished here, and I urge you to keep up the good work. Thank you.